somehow about the story of Christ that was the healer and that could that was forgiving. And so I used to sit in churches when nobody was there, and the ancient churches in the English countryside and around Europe have power. There's something that happened to me when I sat in churches when no one else was there. I felt that power of reverence and just deep listening that was important.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Grbowicz. This season for us is all about listening, and as two Catholics, we're here to listen to people of other faith traditions. This episode marks basically the end of the Buddhism arc. We have another kind of half an episode that involves a little bit of Buddhism, but this is more or less the end of this longer arc that we've had, really as long as it has been, because of how many Buddhists, very deep thinking and practicing Buddhists that Father John happens to know. So it's been really great. You know, in the previous episode, we got to hear from Eva Natanya about her very deep experience of living both a Buddhist and Christian life at the same time. And in this episode, we hear from a person who also has a heart for Christian prayer, even though he is a very devout Buddhist, a very deep practicer. This is an extremely personal glimpse into the life and reflections of a person who, you know, is going to take us on his travels from Tennessee to Thailand, England, and South Africa, as we explore the vast spirituality of Kitasaro Weinberg. And I'll just note that this is another bio where I just struggle through some of these Eastern terms, so apologies in advance. Today we're joined by Kitasaro Weinberg. Kitasaro is originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee. He graduated from Princeton as a Rhodes Scholar and went on to Oxford before going to Thailand to ordain with Ajahn Chah in 1976. He was a Buddhist monk for 15 years. During that time, he helped establish Chithurst Monastery and Divon Vihara in the UK, trained monks, and was a prison chaplain and taught extensively. Kitasaro disrobed in 1991 and has since taught internationally, primarily in the UK, US, and South Africa. With Tanisara, he co-founded and guided Dharmagiri Sacred Mountain Retreat from 2000 for over 20 years and helped initiate and support community development projects in rural KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. He has studied and practiced Chan and Pure Land for 40 years, informed by the Chinese school of Master Xu Yun and Master Chuan Hua, and has completed 2-year-long silent self-retreats. Kitasaro has an MA in Buddhist Classics from Dharma Realm Buddhist University, California, and co-authored with Tanisara, Listening to the Heart, A Contemplative Journey to Engaged Buddhism. In 2017, Kitasaro and Tanisara co-founded Sacred Mountain Sangha, a public charity in Northern California, which offers teachings, training classes, events, and retreats grounded in their unique synthesis of insight meditation and the Kuan Yin Dharmas. So Kitasaro, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Delighted to be here.
Wow. So, I mean, I have some serious questions about some of that. I'm fascinated. We got to talk about the 2 years, those years of silent retreat. But first, I just want to hear about you. I would love to hear about your upbringing and, what your spiritual journey was like, as much as you would like to share of, you know, just to get a sense of who you are.
Well, thank you, Dave. Yes, as you mentioned, I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And my father, Morris Weinberg, a New York Jew that came down in the, from New York to Tennessee in the, late 30s. And he married my mom, Janie Mae Stokely, Southern Baptist. So that was a very, very unusual meeting. So why Dad came down was probably late 30s, maybe early 40s, when the the war, well, it was under FDR, and Tennessee was quite backward in terms of industrialization and poverty, and so they thought of part of the FDR's formation of the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, was create dams on the Tennessee River to provide hydroelectric power, bring industrialization and jobs and things like that. And my dad was an engineer. They needed engineers. But also, you can't make a dam because it will flood things. You got to know what you're flooding. So they had to do some serious mapping before they could do that. And so my father was a part of the mapping. But then for some reason, as then the war progressed, Chattanooga, Tennessee became the center of a new, from aerial photographs, making contour maps for the troops. And so my father was all involved in that. But then a lot of the men were off at the war, but they needed, so they were bringing in women with good math skills. My mom, you know, a country girl from Newport, Tennessee, her mom's devout Baptist, good at math, came to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and that's how they met. And that was, they married after the war, but they met. And at that, when Dad came down south at first, you know, it was some serious discrimination going on. You know, there were signs on restaurants, no blacks, no Jews. You know, Dad with Weinberg name couldn't join the country club. Mom loved golf, so they had to find places where Dad was allowed. When they did get married right after the war, they waited 5 years to have children because mom said, well, we waited 5 years to see if the marriage would take. They knew that there was such a big difference in cultural backgrounds. My father's family were Russian. Father's mother and father separately got out of Russia early part of the 20th century. Came in through Ellis Island. And so mom one day said, Mo, so my dad's name is Mars, but she called him Mo. Everyone called Dad Mo. He grew up Moshe. But she said, Mo, do you think this is for us? And there was a tiny little advertisement in the Chattanooga Times that said, are you a Unitarian and don't know it? And 'cause they wanted us to have a spiritual background, but mom didn't want to convert to Judaism and Dad didn't want to become a Baptist. And so there were only 10 people in the Unitarian churches that time, and they went. And that's how that was our spiritual upbringing, was because it was very non-dogmatic, expressed the sense of a sacred core that permeated all of life, permeated with respect. I mean, I would have heard the name of, of course, Christ and Muhammad and Buddha and Krishna, all of them. But I also was very aware that I was in the Bible Belt, because at school, you know, and in my clarinet lessons, best clarinet teacher was in one of the local Bible schools, and outside his office, I would be told, we're going to hell. And I'd get all upset. Well, because we went into a church that said Unitarian. And I get all upset, and my dad would say, just relax, breathe. They just don't understand. I was quite, years later, I'm quite impressed with my father's patience. But I'm saying this, and then it, you know, this finger wagging thing about we're right, the others are going to hell. I really had an aversion to that. So if you'd have told me then that I'd end up kind of preaching, which I am, you know, but that version that was often expressed of dogmatic righteousness, I didn't respond well to. But actually, what was transmitted through the Unitarian Church had something about reverence and open heartedness, open-mindedness. My dad even became a lay minister and helped them find their first proper ordained minister. So that was, you know, that's how I got started.
Hmm. And I mean, you can give us the abridged version if you like, but what, how did you go from, you know, growing up in the Unitarian Church to becoming, you know, a fully fledged Buddhist,
Yeah,
and
Buddhists, as I like to joke, Buddhists were thin on the ground in Chattanooga, Tennessee, like the person wrote that. And in my early life, I was a champion wrestler. I mean, that was one of my main identities. I was 5-time Mid-South champion, which, you know, the Mid-South is just this little group of schools. But then we went up to Pennsylvania for the National Invitational Prep Tournament, and I won that in my junior year. I came in third 1 year, second 1 year, first 1 year. But my senior year, I was in the finals, and I was ahead with, you know, a few seconds to go. And I should tell you, the junior year, this leads up to the junior year when I won, I don't know, 13-2. I had a dominant victory. And I, you know, mom took pictures and it's in the scrapbooks. And, but, you know, literally not that long afterwards, especially in the photos of all the champions at the end, our little Southern school even won the tournament that year. But I started getting anxious because who am I going to fight next year to defend my title? And that whole anxiety thing, so much of my life in academics and sports was all about the winning and the next thing. And there was a lot of fear in it. So the senior year, I got to the finals, was ahead with, a few seconds to go. I ended up getting penalized and then ended up losing in a referee's decision. But when they held the other guy's hand up, I felt a relief. And I didn't understand that, but there was something by not having to hold that winning, winning, winning thing. And even though I, you know, the worst thing, losing, but there was still, and I didn't understand that. But then with, you know, then, you know, I went to Princeton, and we had a great wrestling coach at Princeton, national champion. And on the first day, I got, even before the season officially started, I was so keen to get going, and they had a Pennsylvania national champion, and a Princeton student with a Japanese background. And I got hurt. We became close friends, but I dislocated my shoulder, and it kept, and then I had 4 screws put in the shoulder, and then at some point I realized I just had to let the wrestling go. But I was already starting to contemplate this illusion of success that somehow you get there. And so I really didn't have Buddhism yet, but then I won that Rhodes Scholarship unexpectedly. And then I think it happened then when I was at Oxford writing a thesis. You know, I was going to go to medical school because I majored in history, philosophy of science. At Oxford, I just wanted to broaden my education, so I was just doing something totally different. But while I was there, so I wasn't wrestling anymore, I was, that's the first time, interesting, Christ came in before the Buddha, is I was wearing a cross. Not because what happened in churches, I didn't respond well to sermons, but that something, somehow about the story of Christ that was the healer and that could that was forgiving. And so I used to sit in churches when nobody was there, and the ancient churches in the English countryside and around Europe have power. And I'd been, my back to the success, life had been so focused on external approval and ratings. And there's something that happened to me when I sat in churches when no one else was there and felt that power of reverence and just deep listening. That was important. And it was in one little church outside of Oxford, little town called Aynsham, that a life-changing vision happened to me. I, you know, I won't go through the whole thing. But anyway, a vision happened that felt like Christ. That was, I when I was in churches, I didn't know how to meditate, but I knew that if you listened, maybe I will tell you a little bit of it. There's a resonance inside. You know, when you listen to a seashell, sometimes you hear the sound of silence. Well, in churches, there's a deep resonance, and this deep, there's a high pitch inner frequency I would hear, but also this low roar. And if I just sitting listening, and I knew one mantra, I knew a sacred word, Om. To me, it was a word that just meant reverence, reverence for this mystery we're in. And I just was saying that. And as that word sounded, and as I said, and already I love just being in quiet places, but places of reverence. Then I started seeing a vision of ancient sailing ships, with the big sails sinking and people drowning. And I was perplexed by that. Well, what is that? But then as I kept listening, then up at near the altar, I was more in the back. A light appeared that started coming toward me, and that light became the head, but there were no facial features. It was just luminous and bright, and the figure was walking toward me. And I guess at the time, like I was, as far as I remember, wearing my cross, it was walking toward me, and each step, the magnetic field. And then the light came from it, went into, I mean, this sounds peculiar, but there it is. It went into my left cornea, into the left side of the brain, to the right side of the brain, out the right cornea. And then my whole body was, we were being drawn together. And I have a weird eye condition that's kind of, I'm a bit legally blind in one eye. I still see, but for driving, I can mainly see with this one. As this figure came closer, the vibration came so strong, and it was delicious. I yearned for that unification, but the power of it, the body, I mean, I'm talking about the electric resonant power. I mean, talk about it. Shaking in power, and literally the eyes were vibrating so much I was scared they would explode and I would, go blind or something. So there was some fear,
Wow.
some anxiety. Now, how this connected to the Buddhism is so bizarre. I, at some point, shaking with anticipation and also some anxiety, I walked out of the church, got into my little car, drove literally 5 minutes away across a little river, across a little toll bridge, into a place I didn't consciously know, but it had a little sign on the, it was a big estate that said Buddhist Center. It's almost like I got guided into there and I met my first Buddhist monk who,
Wow.
isn't that bizarre? So, and then from there, then I did a retreat there, and then there I heard about this Thai master in the forest in Thailand. So I ended up, not long after that, getting a leave of absence from Oxford. And Sir Edgar Williams was the warden of the Rhodes Trust. He looked after all the Rhodes scholars. He was a intelligence specialist in World War II, helping track down Rommel in the desert. And he's quite a character. But when I asked him for, I could justify Buddhism for my thesis on Aldous Huxley, art, science, and religion in the works of Aldous Huxley. I was talking about how the scientific mind, the creative artistic mind, the mystical mind, that these different modes of being are all interwoven. And Huxley was quite, so in Huxley's later life, he got interested in Buddhism. But when I told the warden I'd like to go to Thailand to take a leave of absence because I'd heard about this wonderful Buddhist monk. He said, "No, you can have 2 years, you can go." But he said, "Randy," so I grew up Randy Weinberg. He said, "Randy, you can go, but you're not coming back." And I said, "Oh, yes, I am. I'm going to finish my thesis and then I'm going to go to medical school." And he said, "No, no, he said, "I can see you found your vocation." And I just said, "What?" He saw me better, way better than I knew myself. He said, "I see you found your vocation." He says, "You already have a degree from Princeton. You don't need, at the Rhodes, we're not interested in the, how did he put it? We're more interested in the person than the process." He was just thrilled that he saw that something, and I was sure he was wrong, but he was right. And before he died, I did, even in my monk's robes, I got to go and express gratitude, which I'm glad.
So you moved to Thailand, and is that when you met Thanissara?
No,
no. Oh, okay.
Well, in Thailand, I was, so I was, when I went to Thailand, 24, and I met this this great forest master, Ajahn Chah. I arrived in 76. I ordained as a monk in 77. And then, and again, I was still, even though I was doing the whole Buddhist monk thing, you still carry with you this driven, you know, wanting to be the best, wanting to do the toughest stuff, and which is not bad. I mean, that kind of effort. But it still was a pattern that took me away from really seeing deeper into the what's really going on. So I was doing all these practices, but then I started getting sick. And I had diarrhea for 6 months, and then I got bit by one of the most painful stings in the forest. I got bit by a centipede that was like, you know, five and a half inches long, and you know, almost 3/4 of an inch wide. And
Oof.
And then it was excruciating. Then I ended up in a hospital. I was urinating blood, and you know, I got really sick. And then I got this fever, and it turns out they didn't know right at the time. But then I got this really, so this is in a rural northeast Thailand, fever, delirious, and you know, so I was out of it. And it turns out I had typhoid, you know, typhoid fever. And but the master realized, you know, thank goodness. He had disciples in Bangkok, and what was left over from the American military hospital in Bangkok, he knew some, you know, really good surgeons there, and doctors. So they put me on with some of the other monks, overnight train driver. I was delirious. I do remember someone over me said, "Ajahn Chah's thinking of you and looking after you." But I went, you know, on this overnight train ride, ended up in the hospital, and that's where, you know, I was treated with all these antibiotics for the typhoid. And then I didn't know it, but at the same time, my father was like almost dying of something in Tennessee. So I didn't tell my parents. Well, of course, as I was getting over, and my big wrestling body had been shriveled down to almost nothing. And then after that typhoid, whenever I stood, the whole world, as if I was on a boat, the world was always as if it was rocking. And I had all these ulcerations inside, and then I had, you know, internal bleeding and all this kind of stuff. But then, because my father was sick, my mom sent this frantic telegram, "Oh, your dad's dying." And then Ajahn Chah was just, I feel quite grateful. He just said, "You know, there's no taxis to America." He said, the Thai master just said, by that time, the senior Western monks had started monasteries in the UK. So he just said, "Why don't you go to the UK, help out the senior monk there, and then you'll be closer to your family." And actually, that was very fortunate, because the conditions in Northeast Thailand and the diet was quite really pretty challenging and pretty harsh, especially that sticky khao nhao, that sticky rice. And so I went to the UK and then was visiting my family. And it's in that monastery in the UK, in the late 70s, early 80s, that then when I was a monk there, and we were establishing this forest monastery in Sussex, South England, That's when Tanisra, from her Catholic background, she showed up at the monastery as Linda Mary Peacock, you know, with the nickname Benny. And so then she became one of the first four nuns that was. And so, you know, we ended up, we had no idea then of that, but, you know, we ended up leaving the monastery to be together. You know, like I was after I'd been a monk 15 years, and I think she'd been a nun about 12.
Wow, your life is incredible. And I'm very interested in your thesis, by the way. It sounds really interesting that you were talking about at that you're that I think you were working on at Oxford. Maybe it never happened. I'm not sure.
I never, I've, you know, I just, my advisors wanted me to publish my chapters and this and that. And so, you know, I never finished it. But I had Huxley's first novel was called Chrome Yellow. And I had discovered in my research of Huxley that he had a close friend who was a physicist. And that, and I found in some of his letters that he thought good fiction or should also incorporate the, I'm not, I'm just, I can't remember now, it's been so long, but incorporate the truths and the principles of science as well. And so he had, I saw that he had relativity theory all in there. And that had never been, you know, published. So as my advisor was so excited, you got to publish this. But you know, it's curious that Oxford, they were so keen that, you know, if you write something new, you have to show how this one got it wrong, that one got it wrong, that one got it wrong. And you know, so I never finished, but I'm very indebted to Huxley. So even though I didn't write it, I felt very grateful to his, you know, in his later life, it's a drier work, but it's called the Perennial Philosophy, where he takes all these writings from different mystical traditions and shows this common ground.
Which just sounds like
And
what you were kind of hinting at with the idea that there's these different modes or ways of knowing, right? That
exactly.
you've got the artistic side or the emotional side or the scientific side, and these are not at odds with one another. It's all coming from a human being,
Right.
and we need to be able to access the world in more than just the ways the Enlightenment told us about, basically.
Absolutely. And that way in which they all interweave and are mutually supportive and are rooted in one undivided. And I know Father John speaks and embodies this very beautifully, at least in that recent ceremony, wedding blessing that we did together in ceremony. I love the way you express this undivided sacred ground that we're all part of. And it's not that we never can take issue with things and criticize things, but the there is a, and this is a deep principle in the Dhamma. There's a matrix. There's a And the Buddha even called it a womb. It's in feminine language. It's called in Sanskrit garbha, tathagata garbha. Tathagata is another word for the awakened heart is still in the midst of movement and moving in the midst of stillness. So tathagata. Gata and agata means coming and going. Tata means such. So it's like whether one's still or moving, there's this presence that perfectly merges movement and stillness. And Tathagata Garbha means that awakeness it reveals itself in this primordial matrix or this primordial womb. Garbha means womb within which our life is manifesting. You know, our conversation now, our breath, the different sensations of our body, the thoughts and reactions that we're having in this conversation are flickering. But, you know, there's actually the actuality of our individual and collective experience is a cascade of shifting impressions and sensations and perceptions and thoughts, and that is all appearing and dissolving within this sky-like, space-like, luminous, conscious, present, sacred ground. And yet by the nature of language, we, because of our use of nouns and subjects and objects, we project our understanding of this and that and here and there, and that we misunderstand the nature of language that's just pointing to things. But if we want language to tell us who we are, to there's a place where language can't, where we just can't describe it all. It's just a pointer. So I've just got so fascinated by that. So in the teachings of the Buddha, I just loved the exploring, the scientific, the exploring, and yet the more one aligns with how it is, so interesting, then one's more at ease, and then the creative naturally happened. And then when I went back and looked at what the Christ said, I thought so much of his, you know, when he just said, take the beam out of your eye before you go and try to take a speck out of somebody else's eye. That's meditation. If you had a beam in your eye, that's going to hurt. So you're going to attend to that obstruction, that's right in front of us. And that's another, that opening to suffering is a bit like talking about opening to the cross, you know, or in Buddhism, it's called the noble truth of suffering. And that by that purifying power of working with that, the purification of the heart from delusion, it's like Christ said, the pure of heart shall see God. Well, in the Buddhist, the pure of heart shall see the way things are. So I just more and more, even though I was a Buddhist monk, I felt this deep, I felt the scriptures coming alive in a different way on my own. I got my mom to send me an English, a good English, with a big, because my eyes weren't so good, a good English translation of the Bible.
I've heard many people, and I should put myself in this camp, that the more that I have gotten into Buddhism or even Zen has made me a far better Catholic. You know, it doesn't like surpass something, it deepens something. And because it's at the very heart, getting to that incarnational sacramental worldview where like everything is more than what it appears to be. And that whatever means necessary to have that awakening is really participating in the essence of the incarnation sacramental worldview, which is completely what Christ is. So, I mean, like, and maybe Christians have a specific name for that, being Jesus Christ, but that doesn't negate that reality that exists far beyond, say, the historical Jesus, you know. So, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. And then when I went back, I mean, of course, who knows what's going on, but when I look back and see that vision I had with no specificity of facial features, to me, you know, and it says in, you know, I think in the Beatitudes, the pure of heart shall see God, you know, and Christ saying, you'll do greater things than me. You know, it was pointing to, rather than continually always have Christ out there, it was pointing to a communion, a through deep emptying out, through deep surrender, through deep investigation, through deep relinquishment of the false views that continually split us off from things. So, So this, and in Buddhism, there's a lot of, you know, there's a incredible warning around, even if it's a good view, if you hold any cognitive conceptual framework so dogmatically that it turns into something that harms. So, you know, so how to skillfully use thought in the same way that you know, a knife can be used to harm or it can be used to help heal. So, you know, this is all really, And so with contemplative Christians, you know, Christians that have a sense for deep listening, for prayer, for the prayer that goes into the deeper dimension of interest in what's happening here in this mystery. You know, I find that it's so easy to communicate with, and so the Buddhist Christian work we've done over the years, you know, has focused on that area, honoring the different frameworks and tools and languages we have. But also, a lot of the work we've done has been around doing, you know, in past years, retreats where one is, you know, listening to different scriptures, but also then practicing this deep listening, this contemplation, this meditation.
It sounds like you have a predisposition for noticing to want to be in silence in some way. You were finding yourself sitting in empty churches, like you were saying, and I have to ask you about your experience of 2 year long silent retreats. Because this is unimaginable for most people, I think. And I just wondered, what brought those on? What was it like?
Well, they were wonderful. I mean, you know, to me, as you rightly pointed out, there is a deep, I don't know if the right word is aromatic. I mean, hermetic is not really the
Right.
right word, but aromatic love of contemplation. I get, you know, motivated by, and I strive really hard, and it's not always easy, you know, because I have a sense of a lot of self-judgment and stuff like that, but I love that. So I had been the I guess when I did my first year of silence, I'd been a monk, 89, so that 76, 80. I guess I'd been in the monastery for 13 years, and I'd been the abbot of a little monastery in the southwest of England, Devon, the Devon Vihara, which is a little small monastic dwelling place for a few monks. I was the abbot of that, and it helped found it in this one, the new particular place. And so I'd done that for 3 years. My teacher was quite happy with me, but even though I got over the typhoid, I still had years of sickness, mainly weakness. So 10 years, you know, were quite weak. 3 of those 10 years, I was even lying down most of the time. I was just, you know, just out of it. So after that, the abbot was pleased with what I'd done. He said, "What would you like to do?" And I said, "Oh, I'd love to do a retreat." So he let me just stay in this little hut. You know, there's a whole wonderful story, but I won't tell it, but of how this 100-acre forest in the south of England in West Sussex got offered to our monastery just because a jogger went by and saw the monks, wondered what they were doing, and ended up, "Oh, you're forest monks looking for a forest? I have a forest and I want people to look after it." So there's this beautiful forest, and I stayed in this tiny little hut that was, I don't know, 6 feet by, I don't know, 6, 8 feet by 4 or 5 feet. And it's small, just in the forest. And it was wonderful just for striving. And it was quite ascetic, but I could just do my own schedule. And I did, you know, these different practices. So even though it was silent, I did a lot of prayer, recitation. But then, you know, when I was talking about how, like, the word me is a noun, sounds like a thing, but we all know the me is shifting all the time. You know, how misleading language can be, you know, these nouns imply thingness. So one of the main monastic practices that we were doing was learning to mind the gap between thoughts and be interested in how thought emerges out of this ground, this deep listening silence, and then falls back. And so I was minding the gap, but to investigate how the sense of subject object thingness gets, in Buddhism we call it a sankhara, or these patternings, psychological, emotional, somatic, you know, get perpetuated and activated by our relationship to these thoughts and feelings and the way we interpret them. So when you're minding the gap, you're also, and then questioning. Consciousness normally gets so fixated on what moves through it, it doesn't notice this vast, luminous context, this ground. So I'm very interested in that. And interestingly enough, recitation, especially if you're using another language or a mantra, and when you know something by heart, it moves, and you can, even though it's moving, you can notice that background that ever remains still. So I did a lot of prayers, and I did it from different traditions. I for a few weeks, I just did the rosary. I to me, Mother Mary's incredible, and is so congruent with this bodhisattva of compassion in Buddhism called Kuan Yin. And using mantras of different saints and sages, and also deep silent practice, I just, even though I still wasn't very well, I just, it was wonderful. And I had many arguments with God, with the saints and sages, but then as I was just trying to allow these human desires for success and upset for success and upset if it didn't go right, allowing these patternings to become conscious. And I was so grateful that I was in a context that I could be silent, I could go quietly, and different people would just off put food in my bowl. And I just thought, wow, I was quite grateful about it.
Wow.
I would also love for you to unpack another part of your journey, and that's your time in South Africa. So what could you tell us about that? Like, what brought you there?
Well,
you experienced there?
Also, I think I'll back up a little, because you're right, I have a inclination to silence, but also there's some element of anxiety in there too. There's some fear of contact, or fear, this more discomfort with, you know, some people say, oh, you're born, you're a Piscean, you're very sensitive. Who you can interpret, we can interpret it any way you want, but you know, I can be, and with all my wrestling, I can be out in public. But I didn't find it easy, and I always sort of felt outside. And so, you know, I was most, that's why monastic life was so wonderful. And there was the camaraderie, which was incredible. But then in the forest, I mean, why so many of the major events of the Buddha's life, his birth, his awakening, his first Dhamma teaching, and his dying, were all outside under trees. When you're in nature, it's not always, but usually it leads to an opening. It's rare to be jealous of a tree or jealous of a beautiful sunset. We're in awe. We open. But if you're on your in solitude and then you see another person, it's incredible how quickly the perception of other can, what it can do, what it can stimulate. So I reveled in that, but also, and I had every excuse to disrobe. Doctors were saying, your health, blah, 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 you should. It's not good for you, one meal a day and all this stuff. But I didn't care. I was happy to die. But then falling in love with Tanisra, and you know, that's unusual because you're quite segregated. We never even touched hands, and yet we knew we were supposed to be married. I mean, that's kind of bizarre. I won't go into the whole, never even touched each other. But somehow that was so unexpected, the leaving. And whereas Tanisra is much more relational. And in a way, I think part of my leaving and being with her also was a, you know, continue learning to embrace the world. And so, yes, we, you know, some miracles from old friends from Oxford led to us going to staying in South Africa, but we were, it was supposed to be another monk that was supposed to go, and then he was dying of a tumor. There's a whole story there from a wound. He was in his, he had been a soldier in the Vietnam War for America, and then later his life shifted and he became a monk. He couldn't go because of the where the, he had the wound, it became a tumor. And then some people suggested that we go and teach in South Africa. So this was, I guess, 94, right after Mandela. No, we were invited right before Mandela was elected. And our friend said, "Don't go there. It's going to be a bloodbath. You should not go there." But then when we were thinking about it, when we prayed on it, so to speak, we thought we're going for a peaceful purpose. We should say yes. So we accepted the invitation, and then we're supposed to go right after the elections. So the elections were sometime in 94, and then we arrived in the autumn of 94. And of course, the elections were quite exciting. And here Mandela, 27 years imprisoned, then became the first democratically elected black president. And we, so we arrived just, they really were conducting us. We taught five retreats or something in a period of a month or so. But then unexpectedly, in one of our teaching engagements in the country just north of South Africa, Botswana, someone laughed in a way that just made me say out loud, "I wonder if Kelvin's alive to see the new South Africa." Kelvin was a South African friend I had at Oxford. We rode together in the crew, and he had gone to, he had left before me to go work in the Anglo-American mining, gold mining. And I just, and so we were staying in, we're teaching in Botswana, and this husband of a, the secretary of the little Buddhist group just said something and laughed in a way that just, and I just said, "I wonder if he's alive to see the new South Africa." And the guy, who was a little bit inebriated at the time, just said, "Well, I'll track that guy down, and what's his name?" So I gave his name. He came back with a phone number. He said, "Well, now he's, there is someone with that name in Anglo-American, the big gold company." So when I phoned, by then we taught several retreats, and they really liked us in South Africa. And they said, "You know, please, would you think of moving here to help us with this, to be a teacher?" And when my, when I finally got through to my old friend, and when I said, "Golly, looks like we might be living here," and he, and the first thing that came out of his mouth was, "The least I can do is help you get a place." And I said, "But Kelvin, we haven't seen you in 20 years." And he just said, "Those were the happiest years." So before we left the country in 94, so we went late 94 and we didn't come back till 95, we owned 52 acres of land in the wilderness bordering a World Heritage Site in KwaZulu-Natal. We didn't have a bank account. We didn't have permission yet to be in the country. And the, and at that time in the new government, you were not allowed to hire somebody that wasn't South Africa unless you could prove that no one else in the country that was native South African could do the job. So the center that invited us put into the local Durban Mercury paper a tiny little advertisement that said, "Wanted spiritual directors of Buddhist Retreat Center, preferably married couple with at least 10 years monastic experience. And if you did the inquiry, there's no salary." And surprisingly, we were the only ones that applied.
So basically what you're saying is if I ever need 50 to 100 acres given to me randomly, you're the guy to kind of bring along to.
You know, I just, in, because our leaving was difficult, because there was, even though you're, you don't take lifetime vows, you're allowed to do this. In the time of the Buddha, people went in, people went out, and we, I loved the teachings, but I felt, It was strange. I felt destined that we were supposed to do something together, my wife and I. But it was controversial in our community because they were, we were fairly senior monk and nun. But in a way, South Africa is really in the out there, nobody away from all that community. And on an ancient sacred mountain, that's a whole nother story. But we had the chance to, and we couldn't have done it as a monk and a nun. Now I look back and feel like there's some kind of, these words that, about what we don't really understand, but some sort of destiny. Because it was incredible to be there. Because then, Mandela, who's so inspiring, then the AIDS pandemic hit, and our KwaZulu-Natal was like an epicenter of the catastrophic harm that came from that. And then, of course, there was still the trauma from apartheid and the racism and the systematic, shutting down educational opportunities and the poverty. So, we were right there in that. And those, 30 years were so very powerful in allowing us off the radar to develop the kind of synthesis. And because we wanted in South Africa, because we became a their version of a nonprofit is a public benefit organization. There was the unashamed Buddhist thing, but we made it very clear we wanted it to be to practice, to celebrate the Buddhist teachings, yes, the opportunities, yes, but to have a dimension of being on land and what's your impact on the environment. So there needed to be that, to be embodied and relational. And to address, to be able to be sensitive to what's needed in the community. And we had a feature in our application. We wanted to be a place of peace. So we had this interfaith. We wanted there to be a force for mutual understanding and shared practice and celebrating the common ground and learning from one another, things like that, between the different faiths.
Beautiful. Kitasara, we love to ask our guests one final question before we wrap, which is inspired by kind of why we're even doing this season of listening to people from other faith traditions, and that is to ask, how do you facilitate listening, and I mean deep listening, maybe listening without agenda. How do you cultivate that type of posture of listening in your life?
Well, that's a really good question. That should be a question one asks again and again every single day. And it is, though it might not be the particular articulation of it, the principle of that, I try to practice every single day, in one, listening into body to help me always be here now. The body's all in present time. But to particularly listen into these thoughts that so quickly make assumptions about me, you, the world, how we are. And so what's really useful is to regularly ask who's so sure? Because that humble question, and then if one is practicing every day mindfulness or just presence or awareness and noticing the ephemeral nature of thoughts and feelings and circumstance, when you drop gently, it's not a big heavy thing, a gentle who, and that question dissolves and then leaves that the word mind used to have that meaning too, but we've now reduced it to just thinking, but you can still see the vestiges in language. Mind your step. That's not a thinking thing. Mind means, be aware, listen, mind how you go. Don't mind me. When you ask a question and it returns to the mind itself, awareness itself, then it helps us see some of the impatient, so sure or so doubtful or chronic, whatever it is, patternings that they can be revealed. And somehow the medicine is seeing things as they are. Somehow that can really help. Oh, help a little. Oh, I'm so impatient. Oh, there's such impatience here. It can help an abiding in a deeper, more open form of listening. Anyway, that's, and I really appreciate this. And forgive me if I've just talked too much, you know, but this topic really is close to my heart, and I've grateful to have the opportunity to be with you today and to be on your podcast.
Oh, we've loved it. We're very grateful to you. You're the kind of guest who I wish we could do 5 hours with, honestly. And I feel like we would still be just doing the tip of the iceberg. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kittisaro. Good to see you. And I hope to definitely see you in person again.
Blessings.
Blessings.
Kittisaro Weinberg. Wow. What a full and varied life. You know, over and over again during this Buddhism arc, we've heard the importance of showing up for the person before us skillfully. And I think this is a really interesting thread to pull on in our own lives, no matter what faith tradition we may be practicing or find ourselves in. You know, isn't our most skillful self also our most loving self, and perhaps even our most emptying self? These are things that I'm pondering right now. In the next episode, we have kind of a transition episode, I guess you could say, as we come out of the Buddhism arc and into a few other traditions that we're going to get into next. But before that, we have a double episode next with Brian Lorenz and Clay Dockery, both of whom have lived their lives at the intersection of various faith traditions. And I think there's a lot of richness there for us to explore. So get ready for that. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast, it's also an interfaith monthly gathering that we do online for free. You're welcome to join us. You can sign up for an invitation to the next one coming, whenever this might be that you're listening. Hopefully this lasts for many years. And so whenever you're hearing this, it will still be relevant. I'm recording this in June 2026, and we're about to have our first one on July 1st. As always, at least it's starting out here this way, the first Wednesday of the month. You can find the registration link at our Substack, which is religiontoreality.substack.com, or you can just search for Religion to Reality, and I'm sure you'll find our website, our Substack, etc. The Substack has a blog, it has our episodes, show notes, etc. It's the best way to keep in touch with us. And by the way, it's also a way to reply to us. It's a two-way, you know, that's kind of the coolest thing about Substack as a platform, is that we can enter into dialogue ourselves. So definitely would love to see you there. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources, like I said, at religiontoreality.org or at our Substack. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.